Members will call the meeting of the K-12 Education Finance Division to order. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of Wednesday, February 4th?
So moved.
Senator Newton moves approval of the minutes of February 4th. Are there any discussion? Questions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved for February 4th. Today we have House File 2, Representative Gladding's bill in front of us, and we're going to hear testimony from Representative Gladding. And just so members and the audience know, we are going to get to testifiers by about 3:45, somewhere in there, 3:45 or 3:40. We have a number of testifiers that are here to give public testimony today on the bill, and then also and some public that want to testify on the bill also. So we have about 7 folks after Representative Gladding presents the bill, and so we'll keep it moving. We'll take questions throughout the presentation of the bill. Representative Gladding, would you like to move your bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 finance bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 2 for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative Gladding moves that. We'll move it later again. And a pleasure to have you before the division today, Representative Gladding. And will you please tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a pleasure to have you being chairing the meeting and to all the members. As you know, House File 2 is the bill that we are calling the new Minnesota miracle that many of the legislators have worked on last year. I'd like to thank and name those who did, Representative Carol McFarland, Representative Jim Dabney, myself, and then also Representative Harry Morrow, who was on K-12 Finance last year, and Representative Bud Heidgerken was not officially appointed, but he was at every meeting as an ex officio member, and then the committee was co-chaired by Commissioner Alice Segrin and Senator Harry Bonoff, and in the Senate, besides those, we had Senator Scogin, Senator Cook, and Senator Patricia Torres-Ray. So we had rural, metro members, and bipartisan, and we worked with Commissioner Segrin and the Department of Education. And we got this bill was started with the principles that came from the Governor's Task Force on Education Finance Reform, picked up by PS Minnesota, and we have some of the leaders of that group testifying later. And then the legislators put flesh to the bone and came up with the bill that we have before us. The goal of the bill is so that all students, no matter where they live in the state, can graduate ready for success, whether that's college or university, technical school, or going straight into a good job without needing extra training. And then what does it cost to do this, given that the students are different, areas of the state have different needs and costs? The goal of the reform for finance, which is something we all talk about, let's take this system down from scratch and do something that means something and not just all the political compromises over the years. We've actually done this, and the goal is to have adequate funding, equitable and fair funding, more simple funding, and then part of the bill that's very beautiful that's been there even before this huge deficit that we have is that it is a scalable bill. And it can be phased in over time with any amount of money to begin with. It cannot be begun at all, though, without at least some money, because you can't just flip formulas, and soon we're going to have our fiscal staff go through the bill, and so you can ask your technical type questions. Many of you are familiar with the parts of the bill and have seen our PowerPoint, which I'm not going to repeat today, so that we can get to more technical questions, and then more importantly, or as importantly, get to the testifiers. I will just say in closing that we had hearings, two things. We had hearings all around the state, and wherever we were, everybody loved the bill. There's always certain portions of it, depending on the area of the state, that some like better than others. The location equity is more liked in the metro area, and we did change it a bit as a result of the hearing, so hoping it would catch more counties or school districts, but by lowering it, the only one we could catch was Olmsted County. Then when you get to other areas where they have levies, they don't like the subtractor from the levy and so forth. But they're, but by and large, we think it's a very good compromise. And then in closing, I will just say that my favorite part of the bill is the innovation revenue. And we are going to work closely this session with the policy committee to make sure that we have in place the vision for education that this bill is equitably funding. And they are going to be trying again to tie the new report card to the innovation revenue so that all districts will get the money, but those where their students are making good progress will get the innovation revenue, which has grown from 1% in last year's bill to 5% of the new funding in this bill. If the students are making progress, they get it, no strings attached. If they're not, then they have to come up with a plan based on research, innovative practices, promising practices, whatever the policy committee decides the wording for that portion should be. And then they, too, get the money. We don't want to have any haves and have-nots. We don't want to have pilots for some and not for all. And that's the goal of TS Minnesota, which we've adopted in this bill. But we do want accountability for the money and vision and new ways of spending it that are not just the same old, same old. So we can justify the large price tag of this bill, which is counting the significant property tax relief of $600 million. It costs about $2.5 billion per year when fully phased in, and that's how far behind we have become in our state for funding education with what TS Minnesota calls a Chevy model. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will end and let the staff go through the bill and the questions so we can get to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Gray. So are we having Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom present the financial aspects of the bill? Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, there's several pieces of paper in your packet for you today. There's a note summary, and then there are four different sets of printouts that we're going to reference as we go through the bill. We thought, since most of you are familiar with the concept, we'd go through the summary pretty quick and then spend a little time with the printout and give you a sense of what kinds of information are available on the printout. In terms of the major changes, we'll just real quick highlight those in House File 2, looking off the bill summary. In terms of the debt service equalization program, the equalizing factors are increased fairly substantially. This is Section 1 of the bill. It's tied together with Section 2, which is a credit for ag properties. But the equalizing factors essentially go from their current levels to levels that are essentially twice as high as they currently are. And then the school bond agricultural credit, which is in Section 2 of the bill, reduces the burden on agricultural properties for new school buildings by having a state credit that pays 66% of the cost that would otherwise fall to ag lands for any school construction project. In Section 3, the career and technical revenue, which is currently a levy of a formula that guarantees a portion of a district's expenditures on career and technical programs up to $80 per pupil, is tripled so that the maximum is $240 times the number of students in grades 10 to 12. The next several sections deal with limited English proficiency revenue, essentially about a doubling of the revenue for LEP programs, and the concentration formula in the LEP formula is eliminated. With special education changes, we'll see those on the printout. Essentially, the statewide cap is removed. The formula stays the same at 68% of the district's total cost plus 75% of the excess cost, but the state caps are removed, and for each year further out, the cost of that increases in the first year about $140 million on the special ed front. In terms of the referendum, a couple of equalizing factors changed there. The referendum equalizing factor and the adjusted net tax capacity equalizing factor are both indexed, so that as property tax base changes, the amounts of tax base necessary to reach the equalized level also change. Section 10 of the bill is the location equity index that Representative Greiling spoke to. Essentially, districts where their housing and wage index are higher than the average, up to 90% in fact of the state average, qualify for additional revenue, and those revenue amounts are listed on the printouts for folks to see. In terms of the pupil unit definitions, the current format for counting pupil units, where all pupils are counted at weighted levels, is eliminated, and instead every pupil, including kindergarten pupils, are weighted at 1.0. So essentially the bill would fund full-day kindergarten and change all of the counting to a simple pupil count for each FCE. The pupil count would be 1.0. Rather large dollar changes in Section 12 to the compensatory revenue program, primarily by making nearly all districts' compensatory revenue equal on a per compensatory student basis. Each free or reduced lunch student, eligible student, would generate an amount equal to 33% of the formula allowance, which is $2,500. And those school districts with very high concentrations would see that percentage increase from 33 to 40% of the formula allowance. The next change worth highlighting, probably on page 3 of the summary, the basic revenue amount on section 20, the formula allowance is increased from $5,124 to $7,500 per pupil unit. Section 21, an extended time revenue, as with most components in the bill, is set to key off the formula allowance instead of a fixed dollar amount. So as the formula allowance increases, the money for summer school and other programs that are funded through extended time revenue would increase as well. Section 22 replaces the current pupil weighting that's used for declining pupil enrollment purposes, and instead replaces that with a categorical element where school districts essentially are given additional revenue based on their current pupil count or the three-year average of pupil counts, whichever is higher. So it essentially goes to a three-year average of pupil counts for those with declining enrollment. In Section 24, the referendum replacement revenue to reduce the reliance on the operating referendum, everybody's referendum, each school district's referendum is reduced by $500 per pupil unit. For a district without a referendum, that means an additional $500. For those districts with $500 or more of referendum authority, it removes the referendum aid and levy and replaces it with all aid as a part of the formula. This $500 is in addition to the $7,500 formula allowance. The next large change to highlight in Section 28, the state currently has formulas for alternative facilities purposes, deferred maintenance, and health and safety, and those formulas are eliminated for school districts that are for most school districts, and instead the districts are just given a flat amount of $600 per pupil that can be used for any of those formulas, any of those purposes. If a district was above that level before, they can stay at that higher level. Additionally, an extra $50 million or $50 per pupil is added for technology purposes to the total operating capital revenue item. A couple of transportation provisions are added in Section 30 and 31. Section 31. The transportation revenue, these two new components are for bus purchases. A school district is essentially given 5% of its total transportation expenditures as state aid. For a school district that contracts for its bus services, it can use that money to help pay for the contracts. And then additionally, if a district forms a transportation committee to study safety issues with the district's transportation safety needs, the district can define a hazardous transportation area, and the formula would cover up to 20% of the district's total to and from costs for that purpose. When we look at the spreadsheets, we're assuming on the spreadsheets that each district's going to be at the max, and we're basing it on the most recent data we have, which is 2007 data, which is a couple of years out of date. But on the printouts, every district's essentially going to be receiving the 25%, so we're presuming for purposes of putting out the data that all districts would define hazardous transportation zones such that they could use the full 20%. In Section 32, there's a number of reserves that are created. The largest of those is that 5% of each district's basic revenue is reserved for innovative programs. If a district is not meeting its student achievement measures, then it needs to submit a plan as to how to spend that 5% to the Commissioner of Education. The rest of the set-asides are detailed in Section 34. 1% of the funding is set aside for gifted and talented services. The set-aside for compensatory and LEP that's currently in law remains in effect, as does the set-aside for operating capital revenue. Finally, on the referendum program, the referendum equalization aid has changed only very slightly. Unlike the debt service equalization aid, the referendum formula is essentially indexed, but the indexing doesn't increase the equalizing factors a lot. The first-year equalizing factor would go from about $476,000 to $582,000 per pupil. Finally, Mr. Chair, we get to the issue of the phase-in in Section 41, and the way that this bill is currently written, the phase-in amounts are left blank. What that means is essentially that before this bill were to be passed by this committee, they would need to determine what number of years the phase-in would occur over. But I think the easiest way to think about this phase-in is when we look at the printouts and we see the dollar increase that a district would get under full funding, that the phase-in, if it's a five-year phase-in, essentially in the first year, the district's simply going to get their current revenue plus 20% of that new money. In the second year, they'd get the current revenue plus 40% of the new money. So it's really a pretty simple concept. It's built on top of what's there now, and then after the number of the years of phase-in, however long that is, the old formulas would go away and the funding would come entirely under the new formulas. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there aren't questions on the bill, we'll go right to the printouts that you have in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Are there any questions on Mr. Strom's testimony so far? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strom, you described the phase-in part. You said it's relatively easy or relatively simple. And actually, I had this conversation with Representative Growling, and I'm still somewhat confused about the phase-in portion of it. Can you just cover that and a little more specific nature?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, perhaps the easiest way to think about that is if you turn to the 17-inch printout that's in your packet that's labeled General Education, Special Education, and Facilities Revenue Fiscal Year 2010 at the top, Baseline versus House File 2. If you all turn to that printout, this may be the easiest way to explain how that phase-in works. And if you look at the second-to-last column, the second-to-last column shows the increase over base in dollars that the program would have if it were, that House File 2 would have if it were fully phased in. And you can see there on the top line there is the state totals. The average district in the state's revenue, if House File 2 were fully implemented in the first year, would go up by $2,948 per pupil. And if this bill were phased in over 5 years, essentially what would happen is one-fifth of that amount would go to on statewide, would go out in the first year, two-fifths in the second, three-fifths in the third, four-fifths in the fourth, and in the fifth year the district would be receiving the additional $2,948. So if we were just to go down to the first district on the list, the Aiken School District, you can see there that their increase over base is $3,523. And the phase-in, if we were using a five-year phase-in, would mean that they'd get about $705 per year additional. So in the first year of the phase-in, if it were a five-year phase-in, they'd get their current revenue under our current formulas plus an additional $705. In the second year, they'd get the current revenue they're getting plus an additional $1,410, and so on. So that essentially, if you decide on the number of years of the phase-in, you can just divide that increase by that number of years, and that's how much it'll be in the first year, and every year you'd add that amount again. So essentially, you're starting with current law, and the phase-in is phasing in the new money as a percentage of the total new money. So we'd be making two calculations each year, calculation based on current law and calculation based on the House File 2 formulas, and the portion of the difference, the percent, the based on the number of years of the phase-in, would go out to the districts each year.
Representative Garofalo?
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, at what point then would the the legacy formula be rolled into the new formula at the end of the 5 years is when the is that when it would take place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, at the end of the fifth year, there'd be no need to make the second calculation. The calculation would only need to be made under the new set of formulas.
Using a five-year figure.
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yes.
And Mr. Chairman...
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, under the current funding formula, though, not all appropriations are statutorily limited. There are forecast appropriations, so those dollar amounts on the legacy formula, wouldn't they also be increasing over that five-year time frame?
Mr. Trump?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the general education program, which is the bulk of the money for school districts, does not increase over time unless the student count changes. The formula allowance is fixed there, or unless the demographic factor changes, for example, if there are more children eligible for free and reduced lunch each year, then general education revenue increases. But the general education program doesn't have any inflation built into it. Special education, on the other hand, does have statutory inflation factors built into that program, so there would be some increase in the baseline amounts of special education revenue. Each year, the formula would be calculated both ways so that underlying demographic shifts in the districts would come into play. The relative amounts of the inflation in the special education formula are somewhat small compared to the overall package of House File 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Ruffin, and Mr. Stone. Thank you both. Any other questions before we move to the spreadsheets? Okay, hearing seen none, we'll continue them with the...
So, Mr. Chair, we'll go through the printouts for you. Maybe stay on the long printout that you're currently on. What this printout shows is a per pupil amounts all the way across the page. So if you start in the very left-hand column, you can see the pupil count, the new pupil count that funding formulas would be based on. At the top of the page, there's some averages for the metro and non-metro areas, and then split out by suburban and metro, or suburban and Minneapolis-St. Paul for the metro, and then regional centers and others for the non-metro area. So those are averages on the top 10 lines or thereabouts of the file. And then thereafter, each district is listed with the information for the district. So if you were to take the Aiken School District, just because they're first on the list, you can see they have 1,234 pupils under the new formula that would be their funding pupil count. Their baseline general education revenue, the amount they get under current law right now estimated for fiscal year 10, is $7,267. The next column over shows their referendum in Aiken. That's currently just, it rounds to zero. It's so small currently. The sum of those two is the next column at $7,267. And then you can see for these operating capital formulas that we were talking about, the deferred maintenance, the alternative facilities, and health and safety, that Aiken is currently very low on those, is receiving about $71 per pupil under those formulas. It's special ed revenue in the next column, about $620 per pupil. So its total baseline revenue is $7,957 per pupil. The next set of columns that are separated by the blank column there are the proposed House File 2 revenue amounts. You can see that basic formula allowance by going to $7,500 and converted over with the other general ed elements comes to a total of $10,033 for the district. The district still doesn't have a referendum, so that next column is zero. And then under the proposed facilities revenue, replacing the alternative facilities and health and safety for that district gives them $600 per pupil of facility revenue, and the uncapped special education formula adds about 20% to their special education funding, so that's up to $708. Assuming that they were eligible for the full amount of the transportation revenue, that would be an additional $139, and so you can see then that the proposed total new revenue under House File 2 would be $11,480 compared to the $7,957. And the next three columns are three different ways of expressing that increase. On a total dollar basis, that's a $4.3 million increase. On a per pupil basis, they'd be getting an additional $3,523, and on a percent increase over base, about 44% over base. So in other words, with the average district at the very top line, you can see that the average district would get a $2,948 increase. Aiken gets about $600 more than that. The percentage increase for the average district is about 31.6%, and for Aiken about 44.3%. And the rest of this printout is organized the same way. Each of the districts are listed in ascending district number order, and you can look and see how individual districts compare at a base level on this spreadsheet. The next spreadsheet I'd like to have you look at goes into some detail, and this will be available on the web for you so you can put in all of your district numbers. What we've done for purposes of the hearing today is just print off a district for each of the members of the committee so that they can see an individual data sheet for their particular school district to see how the revenue amounts are changing. This is entitled General Education and Referendum Revenue Fiscal Year 2010 Baseline versus House File 2. And starts with a state total. School district number 1 is what it says at the top. Because of the way the computer file works, it makes sense to code the state totals at the top of the file, and so they're thrown at the front of the packet here. But you can see for each of the amounts, base revenue, extended time revenue, compensatory revenue, you can see the total dollar amounts under current law and the total dollar amounts being proposed. So for example, on the first line, the basic revenue line, you can see that statewide will, for fiscal year 10 will spend $4.8 billion on basic revenue. If House File 2 were enacted and fully phased in, that revenue amount would grow to $6.16 billion. The next column over shows that that's a $1.29 billion increase. And then the next couple columns show those two things on a per pupil basis. And then the percent increase for the district that's listed, which in this case is the state totals. And then the far right two columns on this spreadsheet show the state total, state per pupil increase and state totals for all the rest of the districts when we compare those. So if you were to go down two lines to the compensatory revenue, for example, you can see that the compensatory revenue is $364 million under base, goes to $685 million under this proposal. That's a $391 increase on a per pupil basis, or an 88% increase in that category. And maybe now it makes sense if you turn a page into that, go to the second sheet in the Anoka-Hennepin School District listed on the second sheet, and you can see the same kinds of numbers then for each of the districts that are listed here. As I said, this is a table we'll have up on the web for you so your districts can put in their own district numbers and generate this single page of data for their school districts. And you can see that Anoka-Hennepin, compared to the state averages in the far right column on basic revenue, their basic revenue goes up to slightly less than the state average at about 25.6% compared to 26% for the state average. On compensatory, however, the district would receive a 247% increase compared to an 88% increase. And you can go on down the list and see where they're doing better or worse than the state average, depending on those individual characteristics. You can also see the categories where the funding's been eliminated, such as training and experience, and those kinds of things, and see the new categories of money. For example, the LEI money on the Anoka page, you can see there that the district would be getting about $18 million in location equity index money under this plan, which would be an average of, or it would be an increase of about $480 per pupil for that district. So as I said, in this packet, each of the school districts, there's one for each of the committee members just as a sample. All of the school districts are in the lookup table that folks can look at if they want to look at that file on the web. The next couple spreadsheets we'll spend just a couple of minutes on are a couple of the areas where a few more columns are probably helpful to explain what's going on. If you go to the one that's labeled Special Education, Fiscal Year 10 Estimated Special Education Costs, Baseline Revenue, and House File 2 Revenue. If you look across the top there, and this one's got sort of the shaded header at the top to distinguish it from some of the other printouts, you can see that the column labeled number 4 there shows that for fiscal year 10, we're expecting that the special education costs, once the federal funds and federal costs have been factored out, is about $1.22 billion statewide. Under baseline in column 5 there, the baseline regular special education revenue is about $735 million. The next column over shows the tuition billing amounts that are transferred to non-school district entities, things like the special ed co-ops and that kind of thing. And then the seventh column is the baseline excess cost revenue, which is about $110 million. And the sum of those then shows that for school districts in column 8, the baseline funding is about $802 million of special education funding. House File 2 eliminates the state cap on special ed funding, still keeps the 68% factor in place, so the districts are reimbursed essentially 68% of their personnel costs for special education, but takes off the statewide cap, and that costs the state or saves the school districts, depending on your way of looking at it, about $140 million. And you can see there that the state total then goes in column 12 to about $941 million of special education revenue. Those last four columns then show these on a per pupil basis. The average district in Minnesota has special ed costs of $1,488 per pupil. The baseline special ed revenue is about $976. The proposed revenue under House File 2 is $1,146, so that the increase over base on average is about $170. And you can look up and down the list at the districts and see how their special education costs and how their relative amount of reimbursements will change for each of the districts. A lot of variability in the special education area because it's a cost-driven formula. Those districts with high special education costs are going to essentially have the higher amounts of per pupil revenue increases under this part of House File 2. And lastly, Mr. Chair, if you go to the fourth printout, which is labeled Capital Needs Formula, essentially what's being proposed in House File 2 is to eliminate three separate formulas, those for alternative facilities, which is a formula that allows large school districts to do deferred maintenance work, mainly through the levy, but essentially to do unlimited deferred maintenance through the alternative facilities program for the 24 largest school districts in the state, and that's listed in the first column there. You can see about $148 million of revenue in that column. Then there's a number of districts that do health and safety projects through the alternative facilities bonding or alternative facilities program because their total project cost is in excess of $500,000. That's about $27 million in total for those districts. The current deferred maintenance formula in statute, which first went into place in fiscal year 2008, gives each school district about $60 per pupil for deferred maintenance if they're not otherwise eligible for the alternative facilities program. And then lastly, for the baseline program cost, the health and safety levy, which allows school districts to levy for asbestos needs and fire and life safety repairs, those kinds of things, is about $67 million per year. That varies a lot on a district-by-district basis per year. The overall totals haven't changed a lot. State totals haven't changed a lot, but the district-by-district amounts in health and safety can vary a good deal from year to year. And the sum of all those is then $267 million, or $325 per pupil. And House File 2 proposes to eliminate those categories of revenue and instead simply provide each school district with $600 per pupil in state aid for facilities purposes. However, those districts that have health and safety, deferred maintenance, and alternative facilities revenue above that level are allowed to continue to have the higher level of funding through the local levy, and so are essentially not capped by the $600, but instead have to continue those programs as they currently are through the local levy. And so you can look up and down that list and see in the right-hand column then the net gain for school districts for the deferred maintenance and alternative facilities and health and safety purposes for the district. So these printouts, essentially the expanded printouts on the capital and the special education, are all worked into the big long printout that you've got in front of you, but provide some more detail from how those specific numbers were arrived at. So that said, Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary of the data we've got available for House File 2. One final thing I'd add for you is as the forecast changes at the beginning of March, we're going to get all new data, and we'll have to redo the printouts based on March data instead of November 2008 data, but that probably won't cause big swings in the relative magnitude. It'll be about the same.
I'm amazed at how easy you make this look. You know, I was able to host one of the statewide tour meetings, and I don't remember if it was Mr. Strong or Mr. Crow that was with you, and we had a great meeting there at Brainerd, Crosby, Nisswa, in that area. 100-some people showed up, and they all, you know, for the first time heard this, you know, he heard it explained, and it was so well received and so well explained, because you guys do just a wonderful job with that. Thank you. Members, are there any questions before we move on here? Is there any guidance?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would, before we go to testifiers, like to too thank the staff. While they make it look easy for us when they're telling us about it, and Representative Garofalo's not understanding the transition was because I didn't understand it either, so I had to get a tutorial on it as well. Representative Ward and I both did, and then until we finally understood it. But you talked to me before the tutorial, which is why you were confused. But while they make it look easy for us, I know that they work hours and hours and hours to get all this written for us and all the data, and it has been called elegantly written by Parents United, and it really is a brilliant work that they have done to take the principles that were passed along and put it into this bill, and the fact that it's scalable is the part I appreciate the most, because of our deficit, that with any money that we get or anything we're being cut or shifted or anything we can eke out this year, I'm determined that we get started in some way, shape, or form, because I think there wouldn't be a better thing that we could do for our students than something that takes this formula, simplifies it somewhat, and makes it fair and equitable for kids wherever they live. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Graham. And we're looking forward to hearing from witnesses and public testimony. So unless there are any other questions, we're going to get right to that. Members. All right, so let's call up Mr. Vandell and Ms. Ciccone. And as you come to testify today, please remember to introduce yourself for the tape, and then direct through the chair as we get into questions or comments or whatever. And with that, Mr. Vandell, if you'll introduce yourself for the tape, please introduce yourself and give the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Vandell. I'm superintendent of schools for South Rapids Rice Schools, about 70 miles north of the Twin Cities area. We're a district of about 3,700 students and have been growing over much of the last couple of decades. For the last 4 years, I've worked with a coalition of organizations in the state of Minnesota, which we refer to as PS Minnesota. And wearing that hat, I've had the opportunity to come and testify before you several times before, and it is my pleasure to do so again today. I have to say to you that this always brings just a touch of nerves, and the first time I sat at this chair, it felt a bit reverential. There's a mystical, the spiritual feel about a place like this with the lights and the audience in the back. It feels a little bit like church, frankly. Church is on my mind. I have to race out of here to a meeting tonight. But the last time I was in church, I was helping with distribution of communion, and as watching as people came through and we were offering bread, and they'd accept the bread and grimace a little bit as they'd walk away, and came to wonder why that is until it was my turn, and then realized, well, this bread's flavor is a little bit odd. And what we found was that the youth group had made the recipe, and they had misread teaspoons and tablespoons, and there was a whole lot of salt in this bread. And while it looked like bread and it felt like bread, it certainly didn't have the flavor of what we have come to understand as bread. When we use bread as a metaphor, we've used the metaphor of the Eiffel Tower here several times before, and I appreciate Representative Garling's work on this and the metaphor as well, but I'd like to switch the metaphor a little bit, because I believe that in our work through PS Minnesota, we've found ourselves debating something other than what we have been all about, the height of the Eiffel Tower, so to speak. PS Minnesota has spent the last 4 years trying to assemble an appropriate recipe, and we've also been significantly interested in the adequacy associated with it. If you think about bread, there is a recipe that creates the texture, that creates the flavor, that provides the nutritional value, certainly. And there is also the size of the loaf. This bill in its full form is a large loaf laid in front of you. And in this time of budget deficits, people say, how is it possible that you could create, that you could bake a loaf of bread that large? And we're here to argue that adequacy is important, but we also understand that the recipe associated with the ingredients in that bread are of equal importance. And if you could suggest to yourself that the size of the loaf is the adequacy argument, but the ingredients is the equity and the fairness component, and equity and fairness is significantly important. And frankly, the component of the existing formula that adds the distaste for most school districts is the operating referendum, and the differentiation between those that have and those that don't have, the reliance across the state in some places on the operating referendum in place of the regular formula. We're here as PS Minnesota advocating on behalf of House File 2. We find it to be very well framed. I like Mary Ciccone's words, elegantly framed. We're pleased that we had an opportunity to extend the work of the governor of the state of Minnesota as we continue forward with his adequacy study. We're pleased that we were able as PS Minnesota to build a framework that had components of equity and fairness, and we believe that House File 2 represents the promise for a nutritional product that will feed the children of the state of Minnesota as we move forward. This is a good bill. This is a bill that can be scaled, as has been said. It's something we fully expect to happen, but we do know that the recipe for that bill needs to be carefully framed. It must be framed in that fashion for it to be nutritious for the kids. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Vendel. Very, very well said. Are there any questions, members, comments? Seeing none, Ms. Ciccone, if you want to introduce yourself for the tape as well and give your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Ciccone, and I'm with Parents United for Public Schools. We're a statewide advocacy organization that began 7 years ago from 20 school districts where parents were coming together with levy wins and levy losses and to find out why we were in this situation. They decided to school themselves on education funding and others from across the state of Minnesota and try and work for a united voice at the Capitol. It seems that divide and conquer politics wasn't really helping our kids out. So today we're pleased to say that we have advocates in all 134 legislative districts in the state of Minnesota. I would never presume to be the voice of parents, but I do spend the majority of my time talking and listening to parent concerns, so I will try to represent those concerns as honestly as possible. There are some simple truths that they want you to know. First, for 17 years, the purchaser formula has increased an average of 1.5% a year, every year, and CPI puts inflation at twice that. With the big plan, the state took on the liability for a greater percent of funding for our schools, but they never defined a revenue source with which to do that. And each biennium, that decision creates a significant portion of our state's budget deficit. And before 1990, less than half of the school districts in the state had levies in place. And today, that number is 91%. Secondly, our state has a monopoly board of levy attempts and disparities that have been created between districts based on property wealth. If parents were here, they'd want you to hear their stories about Park Rapids, who without passing a levy was planning on shutting down all of its schools at 3 o'clock. About Frazee, who you heard made 5 attempts just to keep their district from disillusion. About Brainerd, known for its AP programs, having to cut those programs because of a failed levy. They tell you stories of classes where 44 kids are stuffed in a classroom in the metro area to learn reading. Or how lucky they were in Stillwater to pass a levy so that they could buy library books, dictionaries with the word computer in them. And they tell you that this system has turned parents into campaign managers, students into salespeople, and our curricular leaders into whipping boys. They would tell you that by having annual levy seasons, the fiscal credibility of our schools has been destroyed, because nothing works better to defeat a levy than to call into question the fiscal management of our schools. But I think you know these stories, because you hear them every day. They're in your district. Most of you ran for office because you were tired of these stories. You came here to make a difference, but you soon found out that all you could do was tweak the almighty formula. Oh, it's not good enough anymore. Even though Minnesota ranks as one of the top states for education in the nation, we're not good enough. because we're not achieving with the very kids who are going to be our leaders. And that means we're destroying our future. Tweaking simply won't do the job. But we're also the state where our fourth graders outscore the nation and other countries on teams, so we know how to get results. But to do it, we have to move beyond tweaking an outdated funding system. And that's my final point. HF2 breaks the tweaking model. It provides the early learning, early intervention, academic rigor, and innovation. The extra boost our kids need. And an understanding that funding for busing and books shouldn't compete. That reaches needs to people. It provides transparency. The dollars are targeted to the needs of children. That makes sense to people. The dollars are there to support infrastructure costs, the need to open a building and turn the lights on. That makes sense to people. And maybe most importantly for parents who have had it working levy campaigns, it returns us to a commitment that local levies should be used for local initiatives, not for crayons and paper for our kindergartners. It's true that this bill is expensive, but it's equally true that wise investments help Minnesota's bottom line. Some of you heard Dr. Kostarzen last week quote the statistic that each and every one of our kids who fails to graduate from high school costs Minnesota $200,000 in public return to the state. The Alliance for Education Excellence shows Minnesota losing $4 billion annually with our present graduation rate. We simply can't survive this kind of economic crisis. The roles here are clear. You hold our schools accountable for 100% of our kids meeting proficiency in the standards that you, the state, have defined. It is equally critical that you be held accountable for providing the resource and policy necessary to make that possible. And then we all need to be held accountable for paying the bill. Another sheet of truth is that you can't invest in the future without paying the price for education. People who never saw you and I invested in our education, we have to find the will to do the same thing for kids that we'll never see. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coley. Members, questions, or comments? Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for both of you, and this is not meant as an insulting question. I'm trying to gauge the public's understanding of the fiscal situation of the state. Under the current economic budget forecast we have in November, which is expected to get worse next month, if this legislature were to raise $3 billion in taxes in the next biennium, it would still mean that we have to spend less money than the current budget cycle. Mr. Chairman, my question to the testifiers is that something that you knew before you testified, or is that new information for you?
Mr. Vandell, Mr. Coyne?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, well aware, been watching very carefully, and your budget challenge has created budget challenges for local school districts as we're trying to decide, absent good information, how we staff for next year. I'll go back to my metaphor. Your question references the size of that loaf, and I understand that the size of that loaf will change based on the amount of money you have to spend on the ingredients. But the critically important to us as PS Minnesota, all of the education organizations that comprise PS Minnesota, that the ingredients, the proportionality, be appropriate in order for us to accomplish what we need to accomplish.
Mr. Grapple? Representative Grapple?
Okay.
Ms. Coyne, did you want to respond to that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Representative Mariani?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, and actually, I think Representative Graf will ask the fair questions, obviously the question on top of all of our minds, so I don't ask this as any, you know, tit for tat, but, you know, you two have been at this for a while. You've been at this, you know, predating this current fiscal crisis, and I think it's really important for us to obviously deal with the immediate reality that has reshaped reality. But it seems to me that this is an issue that stands apart from that. I mean, I think that you came into being in response to some pretty important questions that we were asking that obviously need to respond to, you know, our fiscal constraints, but are actually bigger than that. And I just Maybe you've already said it, but I just want to give you an opportunity to say that.
Mr. Vandell, Mr. Cody.
Mr. Chair, members, it's so difficult because if not now, when? And I remember the 80s when there wasn't money. I remember the 90s when there wasn't money. I think the difficult thing is I remember the early 90s. Schools were told there was no money, so to tighten their belts. By the end of the 90s, we had the largest surplus ever recorded in the state of Minnesota, And schools were told that they hadn't proven themselves worthy enough to get the dollars. And now we're back into another mode where there are no dollars. If not now, when?
Mr. Vandell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I much appreciate the comment. I have been at this a long time. Doctoral dissertation research on school equity funding back in the 90s. This has been a passion of mine because this is a problem that did not emerge with the economic crisis. This is a problem that's existed for a long time. Mr. Crow reviewed the budget printouts. It wasn't Mr. Crow that Mr. Strom. I apologize. There's one too many Gregs in the room, and I think I'm that one. So, Startup is Rice is at the bottom of these lists of school funding, and prior to my tenure at Sauk Rapids Rice, I was with Eden Valley Watkins, again, a property poor district near the bottom of all of these charts. This is a function of the sense of proportionality, how the resource is distributed. How much resource is distributed is a significant challenge, but how it's distributed is a problem. This bill, House File 2, helps with at least that portion of the problem.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, members? Comments? We have two more witnesses for the House File 2, and so I'd like to bring them up at this time, Mr. Wagle and Ms. Lee Schiffman. And members, this is very good dialogue, and it's very informational, very helpful, and good questions, and so let's keep it up. Mm-hmm. If you remember, introduce yourself please for the tape, and then give your testimony. Mr. Ohl, did you want to go first?
Yes, sir. Members of the committee, first of all, my name is Greg Ohl. I am superintendent of Minnewaska Area Schools that represent Starbuck, Glenwood, and Villard, and other smaller constabularies. I'm not here representing any organization other than the children within my school district, and I met Representative Greiling at one of our regional superintendent meetings and heard about the proposal that she had, and she called and asked if I could come down and talk a little bit about my district, and I guess it would take a minute to do that. First of all, briefly, some of you that are at the table I know as friends, and I even work on some campaigns with a couple of the people sitting at the table here today. But I'm here today as a superintendent. I'm a Minnesotan by birth. Excuse me, by choice. I'm an Iowan by birth, and I've heard all the jokes, and although the one about the cheerleaders grazing was kind of funny, but I'm not here to dwell on that. I'm a military veteran. I'm a Vietnam combat infantryman. I'm a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a superintendent of schools. It started in schools 32 years ago. I've served districts like Red Lake, Minnesota as a counselor and principal. I've been in Holdingford, I've been in Farmington, Minnesota, and currently in the Minnewaska area, which I hope to be my last residence as superintendent here. Minnewaska Schools is a cornfield school. It was built as part of a state facilities grant in 1991. It has three communities that had strong and proud academic and activity traditions that came together. When you bring three school districts together, the younger staff tend to go and the older staff tend to stay. So we have a very mature, experienced staff. And we also, like most districts in the outstate and greater Minnesota, have had an enrollment decline over the last few years. But in the past few years, Minnewaska has been mounting a comeback. We passed a referendum after four failed referendum attempts in 2006. We went into SOD, statutory operating debt, in 2007 and project every three-year climb out. We did it in 1 year. We reduced programs and expenditures and scaled back our services, and with the assistance of our referendum dollars, we have a fund balance in the black. It's not a big one, but it's in the black, and we continue to stay that way. Our district is exceptional in tests, and awards. Our 2007 MCA2 scores are significantly higher than state average in all areas of math and reading in grades 3 through 10, and we do boast a 99% graduation rate. We operate the only, we believe, the only mental health day treatment system service that it still operates in the state of Minnesota, and we serve families and students within our region with mental health services. Our graduates from Minnewaska Area High School can graduate with up to the full freshman year of college completed as they do graduate. And we have a number of partnerships with local manufacturers. In fact, one of them recently won a robotics challenge with North Dakota State University. We were the highest finisher of any Minnesota school in that. This is the first year we have done that. We have the largest Veterans Day program in our region. We bring all the veterans of Polk County together. It's a very exciting time. And we have a thriving fine arts program within our communities. And we have a very successful educational foundation that local people started this past year. But I wanted to talk a minute about, when you look at the spreadsheets and you see the numbers there, when I look at that, I see faces of kids and parents. And if without adequate and fair funding, and I know both those terms are subjective, but the kind of cuts that we've been doing the last 3 years, we've cut out of an $11 million budget, we've cut approximately $500,000 to $550,000 a year. We've depleted our teaching core from approximately 120 down to less than 90 teachers this year. If we don't have a little more stability in funding, the college credit classes will be gone, which means we'll lose students to post-secondary enrollment options. Our foreign language courses, the extras, will be gone. We'll be forced into some unproductive classroom sizes. We're a little bit ahead of you. We've already funded out of our general ed all day, every day kindergarten, and we've seen great results from that. But that's something that might have to be on the chopping block. And we have a very innovative reading intervention program that's shown great strides with our most needy readers within our program. All of these are the kind of things we're looking at having to reduce this year. Our needs are funding that would allow us to continue to employ the best and brightest as far as teachers and younger administrators. And when I say younger, I leave myself out of that calculation. But the cuts that we've done have been so deep that we have teachers that have 19 years experience on our cut list because of the level we've had to cut back in our staff. I know the term adequate is subjective, but we do need at least some kind of recognition that there are inflationary increases that we have to maintain in order to operate our school district. This bill, in looking at it, I haven't spoken very specifically about some of the provisions, but from a superintendent's perspective, if you can eliminate the complexity, it's easier for us to explain to the taxpayers as to what's going on. When you talk about a proration of a proration, it's hard not to see farmers' eyes glaze over at a truth and taxation hearing. And the cross-subsidy that we're required to do to cover from general ed funds to cover our special ed costs has been kind of staggering. So we appreciate the efforts in this bill. Overall, the bill eliminates the sleight of hand that sometimes had to be used in the past, and it removes confusion and complexity of the formulas, and we think that is a good thing. Taxpayers being more informed, we feel, is a positive. The fairness issue, there's a piece of this bill with the regional cost indexing. We understand how different areas of the state have different costs. We realize that all regions do not face the same issues that can complicate the delivery of services. At the same time, coming from a district with almost 40% of the students on free and reduced, poverty does not have a zip code in Minnesota. Every district in the state experiences a population of poverty, and the complexity that those issues bring to the schools and our expectation that we can resolve those are something that we hope you can help us with. In rural schools, we face a lack of, in the past few years, that there's been money in the formula to help us with technology. We feel like we've kept abreast, but we don't want to fall behind in that. We feel that the increasing cost to stay up with, not necessarily the latest technologies, but we're hoping for the 20th century pretty soon. We came out of the 19th, and pretty soon we'll hit the 21st. And the first Minnesota miracle, I actually was a superintendent in Foley, Minnesota. And I don't see many of the faces sitting at this table that were here at the time of that, but Jerry Bowerly Representative Jerry Barley from Foley was. He was a former school board chair at Foley. And the courage and strength that he had to put together with the people that did that really, really showed courage. And I am sitting here today with my wife in the crowd, and we are the parents of three outstanding children, all of which are currently or have recently served in the military. Between them, they have combined tours in Afghanistan, Iraq, Korea, you name it, Western Pacific. My son is deploying in March to be on the largest target in the Pacific Fleet. He calls it the USS Essex, and he's a naval officer. So when I look at what this generation of young people has done, and the courage, honor, and commitment that they show, that was learned in Minnesota's public schools, and at our dinner table, I have to admit that too. But when that kind of courageous effort that they put forth is there, how can we in education and the people that fund education do less? So I would offer a challenge to you folks to keep that in mind. I know you've got a tough job to do. I appreciate Representative Garofalo's situation. Sometimes we have to make investments when we least can. My Iowa background is that of dairy farm with some corn crop. And I remember spent most of my young years putting a wrapper around a corn dryer and trying not to fall off the thing as we dried the corn. But one of the things all my relatives in Iowa would share with you today is in times of economic hardship, you do not eat the seed corn. You have to save next year's crop to put it in the ground. This is that opportunity, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today and would be happy to take any questions with my limited knowledge of school funding. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Any questions, members? All right, we'll move to Ms. Schiffman.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity to address this group, to Representative Greiling for bringing this bill forward, and to each of you for your concern for the education of students in our state. My name is Reen Schiffman, and my personal devotion to ensuring the quality education for the students of Minnesota came to a culmination 3 years ago when I was elected to serve as a member of the Board of Education for Independent School District 197, which serves the first ring metro suburbs of West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, Lilydale, Sunfish Lake, and parts of Inver Grove Heights and Egan. We are a disparate area. While some people may believe that some of our exclusive neighborhoods lead us to be a tax-rich area, 33% of our students are on free and reduced lunch. I presume to represent any group here today other than being a taxpayer who happens to care much about the future of this state. When I ran for school board, it was perhaps for a reason similar to that which attracted many of you to this committee, a fundamental belief that all children should have a quality education that stimulates them academically, empowers them to pursue their dreams, and enables them to reach their full potential. It's more than a lofty ideal, it's an economic reality. Today's students are, after all, the adults who will soon be caring for our communities, and I add somewhat selfishly, making decisions on our behalf as we grow older. In the 1880s, Horace Mann referred to education as the cheapest means of self-protection and insurance. And 150 years later, I suspect economists, and I know that economists, would occur that this still holds true. You ask the question about the cost of funding this bill. I ask the question, what is the cost of not funding this bill? I believe we can all agree that education finance reform is a priority for this state. And while I applaud the desire of Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Steepen to focus funding in areas that would increase the quality of our teachers, the Teacher Transformation Act is not a reform that will cure our ills. It is the current structure of legislative funding for education that is a school board member's greatest enemy. To paraphrase my 22-year-old daughter, when I think about the structure of funding education, that's crazy. In preparing my remarks for today, the movie The Perfect Storm came to mind. While I may not literally be on a boat fighting for my life, I, like so many of my colleagues who hold a similar position and who represent your districts, am feeling pretty darn battered right now. It is as if we have encountered our own perfect storm. Long before No Child Left Behind became vernacular, our state stepped to the plate to ensure that all of our children received the same quality of education, whether they lived in a property tax rich or property tax poor school district. The strategy was found. By funding districts sufficiently and equally at the state level, disparities among districts would be minimized. Based on the state's current funding structure, not only is funding not sufficient, it is creating inequitable results. Annually, our increases from the state have been so small that they don't even cover increased costs for necessities as mundane as fuel and insurance. New textbooks, they are a luxury. And even though all of us are taking extreme measures, and I assure you that we are, to not only contain costs, make painful decisions, and secure private funding, it is still not enough. 2 years ago, our district cut its budget by $1.6 million. Even without the economic downturn, we knew that next year we would have to cut another $1.6 million. Now we're looking at $2.2 million in cuts. To put in perspective, that's about 10% of our budget. Simultaneously, we are faced with the added challenge of fulfilling mandates that come with expensive price tags and few dollars attached. Let me give you a taste of what this means for our district. Last year, we had to divert $4.5 million from our already stretched general revenue fund to compensate for unfunded mandates in special education, in ELL, and in transportation. Now, I admit the legislature has given us a fix. We can ask permission from our voters to voluntarily increase their taxes. The fact is that even during good economic times, this is an iffy proposition. I have been on the board for 3 years, and I'm about to hit my third attempt to get a levy passed. It's downright grim. For many of these people, especially in our district, who are on fixed incomes, a vote on a levy is not about education. It's about self-preservation. Folks, the boat is not just listing, it is sinking. And a push for good teachers won't change the outcome. Good teachers will not eliminate the barriers that force our districts to divert dollars from our general revenue budgets to cover the gap for mandates. And linking teacher performance to testing will not remove a need for our district to sacrifice course offerings for energy and fuel payments. Even if the state does establish requirements that have the potential to provide us with the most remarkable teachers in the nation, what is going to attract them to teach here? It's akin to hiring an engineer to build a bridge over the Mississippi River and tell them that you're not going to give them a computer, you're not going to give them a calculator, you're not going to give them a desk, a chair, a phone, or even a decent salary. What you will give them, though, is a slide rule. And that's it. Teachers require a supportive infrastructure, too. There's only so much a vibrant teacher can do when placed in a room with 40 middle school students. I don't know if anybody here has a middle school student, but it's not easy when you put 40 of them together. There's only so much the finest first grade teacher can do when 30% of his students are just learning English, and there is no funding left for a paraprofessional. There's only so much a music specialist can do when schools can only afford to bring her in for 2 hours a week. There's only so much innovation a teacher can employ without resources. Then again, there are only so many good teachers this state can recruit when we are already sending their colleagues to the unemployment lines. It's for this reason that I implore you to consider the new Minnesota miracle. I'm telling you from the front line, and as you can tell as a frustrated board member, that the system of education financing is broken, and that to do anything short of dramatic over the next few years will be this state's undoing. Certainly, I can understand the reluctance to make promises about whether the state can afford to fully implement the proposed miracle at this time. I'm not asking you to do so. I am entreating you to welcome the opportunity to use this as a means to begin to fix the system. Last year, during remarks at the Humphrey Institute, Al Quie wished for a time that Governor Parente could totally divorce himself from politics and focus on the good of the state. The time has come for all of us to set aside politics. I'm asking you to roll up your sleeves and to come to the table with an open mind. The proposed miracle may not be perfect, but it's a start. And that's the farthest we've come toward getting to the root of this issue in a very long time. Please don't throw away this opportunity. Horace Mann, credited with education finance reform years ago, said, "Let us not be content to wait and see what will happen, but give us the determination to make the right things happen." May it be so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Schiffman. Members, questions? We've got three more testifiers here today, but we'll take some questions if we have it. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Question for the superintendent, Mr. Lowe. You touched on the equity location index just a bit. Being from our state, do you think this bill addresses that equity and fairness issue well enough? Are you satisfied that it looks at that and does a good job with it?
Mr. Lowe?
Representative Anderson and committee members, actually at this point, I think my response would be, I think it's an idealistic start. I don't know that you're totally at the answer, at the answer that you're going to need to derive to make this more palatable for outstate schools. We in the outstate, though, have to look at this as a bigger picture issue. I mean, there may be, Anoka Hennepin may have issues that Minnewaska doesn't have. Sauk Center may have issues that, you know, the Minneapolis district doesn't have. But I think at this point, it's a good start. I know it's been revised from the preliminary things that we saw last spring. I don't know that it's going to go all the way to make all the MREA schools, which we're a member of happy, but I think everybody wants to be at the table and have the discussion. So I guess it's a big enough issue that has to be worked out, but I don't think it's a reason for inaction.
Thank you, Michelle. Is there anything else? Okay. Thank you, testifiers. I'm going to call the last two testifiers, and we'll have the last one down by himself. So, Ms. King and Ms. Smith. Ms. Kim King and Ms. Stacia Smith. Again, if you identify yourself with the tape and proceed with your testimony, Ms. King, do you go first? Is that okay?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Kim Kang. I'm the Public Policy Director at Pacer Center, and I'm here today to represent the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. The Coalition actually consists of 8 statewide organizations that advocate for children with disabilities around special education issues. That includes the Pacer Center, the Autism Society of Minnesota, United Cerebral Palsy of Minnesota, Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, the Minnesota Disability Law Center, the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, Upper Midwest Dyslexia Association, and the Minnesota School Psychologists Association. As I stated, we represent around 122,000 children with disabilities in the state receiving special ed services. And, of course, we, are very supportive of House File 2 for adequate and fair funding, especially for special ed. But I always realize special ed is always the elephant in the room. We are probably the elephant that's 2 times larger than everybody else. And we're very pleased that PS Minnesota and Parents United and Representative Greiling has brought this bill forward so we can actually have fair and equitable funding, not only for special education, but for all of our children. Because too often we have seen kind of piecemeal from appropriation session to appropriation session for children. And this is really about all of our children. Having limited funds, this has been really detrimental not only to children in special education, but it has divided parents at the school district level, which is a real shame. You know, we should all be in this together to help all the kids in education. So we just want to applaud your efforts and strongly support House File 2 to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. King. Any questions, members? We'll move on then to Ms. Smith.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name, for the record, is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the state's largest business advocacy organization. We represent over 2,700 members, 80% of which are 100 employees or fewer, meaning they're small businesses. And I appreciate the opportunity to let you take me in for public comment on this bill today. I had the pleasure of welcoming Representative Grayling to the Chamber's Education and Workforce Development Committee earlier this year to discuss this bill. And I'm just going to lay out a couple concerns that the business community has relayed to me, and it has relayed to her also in that committee. And I do want to note that that on that committee sit a couple of folks who wear both hats, of school board members and also of business members. So we get a really good, I think, perspective. It's not just straight business. So the Chamber is concerned about the cost of this bill, given the significant deficit. Usually the Chamber doesn't take a position on overall education funding increases. However, this bill represents a biennial increase in state spending of $5 billion, and that's in addition to the $14 billion that we already spent on education. So to me, doing the math, that's more than a 30% increase in state funding. So we're very concerned about how this will be paid for. Now, I know this isn't being discussed today in terms of how it will be paid for, but we are concerned because at the end of the day, it's going to have to be, someone's going to foot the bill. Even if this funding were available, we're wondering what evidence is there that student performance would improve, and if it were to improve because of this money, by when and to what level? We'd like to see some measurable goals set and attached to this funding. We are not necessarily opposed to specific investments. We just want to know what we'd be getting for increased dollars. So we are concerned that money is not necessarily just the only driving factor in improving student performance. We do know what are the driving factors. We know that teacher quality is a very important factor. We know that for those achievement gap kids, increased time on task is a very important factor. And we'd like to see our policy focused on that and our any specific investments also focused on that. And then also given the changing demographics and rapid increases in state spending, especially in healthcare, we feel that this could be very unsustainable. I also want to note that we're concerned about getting rid of TUCOMP, which this bill does. Even though there is innovation aid, and I talked to Representative Grayling about this, and I think that we can work things out on it, but TUCOMP exists in its first few years, and I think we owe it to those districts who have bought into this program and like this program, so that we continue to work on it and reform it rather than throw it away. Also, the Chamber feels that future changes in the formula should be a decision by the legislature, not guaranteed in law. And I'm happy to take any questions.
We have one question, Ms. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Smith, I appreciate your concerns and the business community's concerns. I think a lot of us share those concerns about the revenue available for this bill, as has been discussed earlier. If we had one additional dollar this year, and that was it, to put into education funding, would the business community support its going towards this new Minnesota miracle?
Representative Morgan, thank you for that question. Ms. Smith?
Thank you, Representative Morgan and Mr. Chair. If there were $1 to spend on education, I believe that we would support the money going towards helping the students who fail to meet the grad test to keep them in school until they meet the state standards, so that they are not put into an environment, into the workplace, or into post-secondary education where they're less prepared than their peers. And I think we all know that those populations that will be failing the grad test are disproportionately those who are from minority and low-income populations. And I think it's a disservice to either take away that standard, lower that standard, or not give them the skills that they need before letting them have a high school diploma.
Representative Morgan?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that under the new Minnesota miracle, schools would have the opportunity to do just that and have some local control in addressing those concerns. But my second question is, under this bill, innovation revenue, 5% of the revenue would be required to go towards innovative new ways, research-based, best practice ways to improve student achievement. We don't really have any requirement like that in law. Obviously, school districts are doing all that they can. But with this new additional revenue, 5% of it would be required to do that, and the accountability would be that school districts who have students who are not meeting those standards would have to submit to the education department their plan to remediate and address those issues. Is that not sufficient for the business community? And if not, what more would you like to see?
Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan. We have supported the TUCOMP initiative in the past, and I know this innovation, these innovation dollars are sort of a replacement of the TUCOMP. program. And I think that we owe it to the program and to those districts who have bought into the program up to this point to reform CCOMP rather than completely taking it away. I think that there's ways we can take a lot of the components that you mentioned that are very interesting and very attractive about this innovation aid and put it into the current CCOMP program. We'd be willing to have that conversation, absolutely.
We've got one more question, and then we have one more testifier, and then we have some folks who want to ask the author a few questions. So we'll take Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my question is for Ms. Smith also. You know, during your testimony, you were talking about economic challenges right now, and even if you were to support it, not that you are, but what would be the results? What would be the outcome? Is that do you think that those thoughts or that comment stems from a feeling of a lack of accountability, or do you think that it is coming from more a lack of reform to the system?
Ms. Smith?
Thank you, Representative Dietrich and Mr. Chair. Let me know if I'm not answering clearly, but I think I understand what you're asking. I think that we would be more supportive of a strategic investment that had measurable outcomes attached to any increases in dollars than we would be to this type of bill, which increases the funding to an adequate level but doesn't have any reform attached to it. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat, but I feel that gets a little schizophrenic a little bit, in my mind at least, though, because of the fact that although then, you know, you strongly support QComp, which obviously if you've heard my comments in the last week, I don't. And so there are no measurable outcomes for QComp, in my opinion. And so I would really question, why are we taking that huge leap of faith with no measurable outcomes? And that is a lot of money. Make no mistake about it. And saying that that's a good system without measurable outcomes. But anyhow, so what I am wondering is, so if we said X number of students were going to score better on the MCA 2s, is that the type of measurable outcomes that you're looking for? I'm just wondering, because I know the business community for a long time said they want an accountability system in place. And so we have moved there. You know, we have testing at most grade levels now. We have a growth model. We have all sorts of ways to measure kids and what is going on. And then they said, then the next step is publish those. So now we've done that. And so what more do we want? Is what I'm trying to get at. Where do they want us to take it? Just more kids passing the test? That would be adequate, or what?
And we've got one more testifier, so Ms. Smith, if you could be real quick, I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dietrich. First, in your comments about QComp and investing in a program that doesn't have accountability attached to it, I completely agree that we need to have measures as to whether or not it's improving student achievement, absolutely. But I also would make the comment that there are a lot of ways in which we invest in dollars at students trying to improve their performance, and it hasn't worked for many, many, many years, and we haven't done anything about that. So this is only 3 years into it. I think it deserves some more time. I think make some changes. Representative Morgan mentioned some of the components of the innovation. My money, I think those could be implemented into QComp. But then secondly, about what the business community is looking for in terms of accountability, I think that the legislature this year is going to be put in a very difficult situation with the grad test. And the business community for a long time has really advocated for improving standards. I can tell you, and we're going to have some discussions later on this year in Representative Mariani's committee next week about what the business community is experiencing in the field. They're competing internationally, and they need support from their employees to be able to compete internationally as well. And what we're seeing is that employers are increasingly dissatisfied or very concerned about the level of skill that high school diploma carriers have. And this year, we have an opportunity to raise the bar on that with the grad test, or take the bar away completely by offering a 3-year short-term solution by basically allowing anybody who can't pass the test a way to get through anyway. I can tell you that I brought this issue to the business community last week. They said, we have got to hold the line on that, that we've got to figure out a solution in order to get these students to have the skills before they leave. But we cannot just retract because they're not able to reach these higher expectations, because I can tell you that other countries are raising their expectations. They already exceed their expectations.
Okay, Ms. Smith, I'm going to need to get to the desk desk for
I apologize, too. But yeah, that would be...
Thank you. If Mr. Halverson and the author could move to the testifying desk, please. And Mr. Halverson, I apologize, but we only have a couple minutes for you, because I do want to get to some questions members have of the author. So, Mr. Halverson, please... introduce yourself. And
I'm Bill Hattestad, Corcoran, Minnesota. I graduated from the service over 60 years ago, and I'm very involved. I've been a successful businessman working for national companies, and I've been spending at least 50% of my time helping others. And my big thing today is education. I lived in Minnesota three different times, and I returned the third time and set up my own businesses. Why did I choose Minnesota, having been a farm boy from Ohio? Because it had a great educational system. And that is the foundation for everything we do as individuals. If we don't have an education, we aren't going to get anywhere. I had the audacity in a statewide meeting of an association to rise and talk to a couple of your leaders. And this leader had finished his talk and he said, what are the questions? I informed him that I'm Bill Halverson, and I'm very disconcerted by the inadequacies and the unfairness on the petitioning or partitioning of the money between school districts. And when I finished, he said, you're entirely right. It's a disaster in the state of Minnesota. So this has to do with the apportioning of the state's fund. The next man that was up in the dais, a great big guy, and he was talking back and forth. Turns out he's all party, probably going to run for governor here in a few years. And he said, you're entirely right, Mr. Halverson. Both of them gave me their cards. They want to talk to me. I have conditionally, and I will. But this emanated then and developed into being recorded by public television, and you'll see it here later this month. It's my legacy letter, and I'm going to read it to you. It's 1 minute long, so bear with me. Many of us have always been proud that Minnesota has enjoyed a national reputation for its educational system. The need for great education continues to grow. Yet many of our schools are suffering because of a lack of funding. It is essential that we change Minnesota's allocation of resources. As it is now, school board areas with wealthy residents or large tax bases provide a higher quality education in contrast to school districts with a relatively lower tax base or less wealthy constituency. Is this really what we want? I, for one, am opposed to leaving any student behind because of his or her luck of the draw. I believe we must maintain Minnesota's reputation and help our state and nation build a vital and prosperous economy for the benefit of us all. Bill Halverson, Corcoran.
Thank you, Mr. Halverson. Thank you, Halverson. Thank you. We've got time. Representative Dickens has asked to ask the chief author a question or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and noticing the time and having once been a committee chair myself, I'll defer to Chair Grywin if we come back tomorrow, if I may be able to ask some of the questions. This is the first time I've had an overview of the bill, so some specific questions, and with that assurance, I can wait till tomorrow.
Mr.
Chair and Representative Biskins, yes, you are new to the committee, and we should have time for questions. Tomorrow we have a very full agenda with the testing topic. So let me think about it. We'll make sure that we get them in. We, of course, by the time we get to the end when we're marking up the bill, we'll be, I think, too late to hear the questions that you have. So we'll get them in sometimes, but I'm not going to promise yet for tomorrow, just because knowing what we've got on our agenda for that day.
And Mr. Ward, Chair Ward, and Representative Brown, I can roll through these pretty quick. Okay. They're kind of yes and no. On a couple of issues, and I noticed that they're connected, so the answer is probably the same on both, but you move from site-level funding to district-level funding. It's in compensatory revenue and in free and reduced price lunches. What was the rationale for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the rationale for that was districts like Anoka Hennepin that made a very good case that they did not have their students in need all congregated in one school or another school, but in total they have significant numbers. And so we still have the money follow the child to the site once it comes to the district, but we calculate it based on the district, and that is fair to districts to accommodate poverty that might be more spread out. We do keep the concentration factor for compensatory because we do think that makes a difference too if there's large concentrations of poverty. But we're accommodating both avenues for paying for kids who cost more, which is the total purpose of the bill is to make sure all kids graduate ready for success, can pass our tests. And so to answer the Chamber of Commerce questions, that's what the whole bill is all about, is accountability.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll skip over a few of these and ask them at a later time. But on Section 39, Madam Chair, you increase the building lease levy from $150 per from $100 to $150 per pupil. What was the rationale for that?
Now, Mr. Chair and Representative, this part of the $600 that he's talking about, no. Okay, I'm going to defer to Mr. Crow because he's telling me I'm in the wrong
Mr.
direction.
Chair,
I've got to get my bill out.
If you look in the bill text, this is something that didn't get changed from the draft last year. Last year's school finance, the omnibus bill or whatever it was when it got rolled all together, made this change. So the only change in the bill is to authorize districts to lease administrative space because it's already at $150, and for an intermediate it goes from 43, where it was raised, to up to 50.
And Madam Chair, I noticed that there are things in here that I can support, and I do appreciate all of the effort that you put forward. Now, if at worst case scenario, education funding is simply held flat, right? So I was more confident of that than I was after Senator Pogamore made his comments late last week. Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, if it's at least held flat, are there any components in this bill which can be implemented at flat funding?
Representative Gray.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, if it's flat funding, I think that we could rearrange priorities within our current budget to get started at this bill. That would be my intention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, we've heard great dialogue today, great questions, powerful messages. I want members to know this. On Thursday, there's going to be an add to the agenda. We're going to have two of Representative Dietrich's bills instead of one of Representative Dietrich's bills on Thursday, so that's an add to the agenda. This bill, House File 2, will be laid over for inclusion on this K-12 finance bill. This meeting is adjourned.